You're listening to Because Science, a new show from WPR Next at Wisconsin Public Radio in collaboration with Discover Magazine. I'm Veronica Rickert. Today on Because Science, have you ever looked up at the stars and fallen in love? Eric Wilcotts has, and we'll find out how a backyard telescope helped launch him toward a life spent tracking down the secrets of the universe.
I've got a lucky career. This is fantastic. To be able to think about and study and look at magnificent things in the sky.
And a tech expert gives us a strategy on how to fight one of life's great battles, figuring out how to navigate a world full of screens. And I'll go mano a mano with a Wisconsin listener to try to guess who said it, Stephen Hawking or William Shatner.
I will destroy it.
But first, who doesn't want to go to a real-life Jurassic Park, even though the always sensible Dr. Ian Malcolm thinks it's a pretty bad idea?
Your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could that they didn't stop to think if they should.
Condors are on the verge of extinction.
Oh,
if I was to create a flock of condors on this island, you wouldn't have anything to say.
No, hold on. This isn't some species that was obliterated by deforestation or the building of a dam. Dinosaurs had their shot, and nature selected them for extinction.
Right now, nobody knows if we'll ever have the material or the tools we'll need to clone dinosaurs, but research is breaking new ground. Elena Schrader is a postdoctoral researcher at North Carolina State University. She and her colleague Mary Schweitzer led a team to analyze collagen peptides from an 80-million-year-old dinosaur and to confirm earlier findings about just how long preserved collagen can last. Elena Schrader joins us now to talk about this research. Elena, welcome to Because Science.
It's great to be here with you guys today.
Well, why did you decide that you wanted to take a fresh look at dino collagen?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. One is that Mary originally did work with collagen peptides from a Tyrannosaurus rex in 2007 and the dinosaur that I looked at, Brachylophosaurus, in 2009. And the scientific community still had some controversy about whether or not to accept these collagen peptides as endogenous and original to the dinosaur bone. So one of the things that I wanted to do was rerun the tests in a very rigorous manner so there would be no question that these were actually dinosaur peptides.
I'm going to stop you and ask you what the word endogenous means.
So endogenous is a really fancy term for that it actually comes from the bone itself and not contamination from outside sources. The controversy is that people think that it might have been from modern sources, from the lab environment, or if a chicken had been like in the dirt near the area of the dinosaur, that it could have been from something more modern as opposed to something that was ancient. One of the things that I wanted to do was show very clearly that it wasn't anything from the sediment, it wasn't anything from the lab environment, and that it actually was from the dinosaur itself. And the other thing that I wanted to do was see, because in the intervening, I believe, 7 to 8 years since Mary did the original study, technology has advanced, search software has advanced, and the databases of proteins from which you use to identify sequences from this kind of research has advanced. So I wanted to see if when we took a second look, we could actually get more information than we had the last time.
Okay, well, let's go back to the dino collagen peptides that you're looking at. Let's talk about what exactly they are.
So our bones are made up of a combination of minerals and proteins. And in our bones, the most abundant protein that is present is a protein called collagen 1. So the peptides that I found from the dinosaur bone are actual fragments of the protein collagen 1 that we would expect to find in a bone.
Why does it matter? Mm-hmm. Why does it matter whether or not these findings, checking out this preserved collagen, is important to the field?
So one of the things that's kind of, sort of unique almost about paleontological study is because everything is extinct and we don't have the living organisms, everything we know almost about dinosaurs, we know from the shapes of their bones, what we call it morphology, the morphology of their bone shapes. And that can get you a surprising amount of information from an organism, but it's still kind of limiting because whereas with modern animals, we can look at their DNA to investigate things like how closely they are related to one another, it's really hard when all you have is the shapes of bones because some animals can look similar and not be related at all. So one of the things that you can do with proteins is because proteins are encoded from an organism's DNA, they actually are kind of tangential genetic information. And the sequences we have in our proteins can actually also show those evolutionary relationships between organisms. My collagen and the collagen of other primates are going to be more similar to each other than my collagen and collagen from a mouse. So if we can get sequences from proteins of dinosaurs, we can investigate in a completely independent manner how closely some dinosaurs are related to other dinosaurs.
Interesting. So this is different. We're talking about proteins here. We're not talking about DNA per se. How does this answer different questions than that might?
So it's interesting. DNA would answer a ton of questions, but we can't actually get it as it currently stands. DNA is actually a much more fragile molecule when it comes to preservation over long periods of time. So we have not been able to get dinosaur DNA. I don't think we will be able to for a long time, although you can never say never. But proteins are much more stable, and we've shown they've been able to preserve. So it's not as much that we can get more from proteins, although there are some different things we can get, as much as we can actually get proteins. We can actually get those from dinosaurs. We can actually use those, while DNA is pretty far off.
Now, you use the bones for this research of a kind of Brachylophosaurus. I think I'm saying that right. Can you tell us about
Brachylophosaurus?
Brachylophosaurus. There we go. What tell us about this dinosaur. What did it look like?
So this is a type of dinosaur. It's known as, the general term for this group is hadrosaur, and more commonly known as duck-billed dinosaurs. So if you've ever seen a duck-billed dinosaur, that's what this one would have looked like.
Well, I have to ask you, and forgive me because I'm sure that paleontologists love getting the Jurassic Park question, but does this mean that any of the work that you're doing here could lead to a future where Jurassic Park is possible, maybe without the dinosaurs that eat you?
I'm usually more surprised if this question never comes up, and it never has never come up. So what you would need to clone a dinosaur is actual DNA sequence and a fairly complete sequence. And the kind of the great thing about working with proteins is that you can get fragments and it'll still tell you something. Like you can get a fragment of a protein and identify the protein that you have and the sequence of that fragment and then use it. For example, collagen, you can get a piece of collagen and identify it as collagen. With DNA, DNA is like this big, long instruction book. And if you get a fragment of it, DNA is actually the instructions for making all your body's proteins. But just a fragment in isolation isn't going to tell you much, and it certainly isn't going to allow you to clone anything specific. It's kind of like getting a scrap of paper from a book that has four words written on it, and you can't tell the story from that. And that's assuming that we even could get dinosaur DNA, which the process of extracting and analyzing DNA is completely different from what we do with proteins. So even the methodology that I'm using for proteins can't be transferred to DNA, unfortunately.
So as a scientist, though, who studies dinosaurs, is that a future that would interest you? Or do you think that it's so sci-fi-y and unrealistic that it's outside the realm?
So it's kind of one of those tough questions, because the professional scientist in me thinks it's a bad idea. Because first of all, if you're going to clone a dinosaur, then you're going to have one dinosaur who, you know, does not have an immune system that's equipped for modern day, the digestive system, we wouldn't actually, assuming that we could do this really far off thing, there would actually be a lot of things that are complicated about trying to have this one organism in isolation that you don't really think about when you think about how cool it would be to clone a dinosaur. There's actually a lot of problems even if we could do it. But the child in me does want it to see a T-Rex. So I kind of go back and forth. Like, it would be extremely complicated to even get tiny fragments, even if they are present. So it's one of those things where I much prefer to work on proteins, even though everyone wants a clone dinosaur.
Elena, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Elena Schrader. She studies dinosaur collagen at North Carolina State University. Next stop for her, Tyrannosaurus Rex. Okay, quick. Can you name a scientist? not Einstein or Galileo, but an actual living scientist. If you can't do it, don't beat yourself up. You're not alone there. David Steen wants to change that. He's an assistant research professor with the Alabama Natural Heritage Program at the Auburn University Museum of Natural History, and he's out there on social media helping to ID snakes for people on Twitter, and recently he inspired the viral hashtag #ActualLivingScientist. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You made news when you decided to introduce yourself to the world as a scientist, and this was a viral sort of hashtag that got picked up and repeated online. What made you think that it was time to introduce yourself to the Twitterverse and, by extension, the world as a scientist, a real living scientist?
Sure. Well, the majority of Americans can't name a living scientist, and that's one of the reasons I'm active in science communication and outreach. And somebody was giving me a hard time the other day about how he didn't personally value the work that I did. And I was just trying to understand it from his perspective. So I said something along the lines of, I can't really expect people to appreciate what we do if they don't really know us as scientists. And, you know, we see a lot of controversy today when it comes to a number of scientific issues like GMOs, genetically modified organisms, vaccine safety, teaching of evolution, and, of course, climate change. And I think in a lot of cases, scientists just aren't trusted. So I want to chip away at that. I think that if more people knew scientists, knew that we're just people, we can start, like I said, chip away at that skepticism that many people feel and kind of talk to people about and introduce people to the evidence that leads scientists to believe the things that we believe in.
What do you think is going on when a majority of Americans, almost 70%, can't name an actual living scientist?
Good question. Well, we're just not in the popular press too much. We're just not on people's radar screens. There's a couple articles, there's a couple TV shows, but I think we could do more to come to the forefront of the public consciousness.
And what do you think the general public gets wrong about scientists?
That's a good question. I think that people tend to think that scientists are robots, you know, ivory tower elitists, not interested in anything we don't learn in a book and no real-world experience. And I don't think that's very accurate. And also, if you ask people to describe a scientist, often they'll picture a white man in a lab coat. And really, scientists are a lot more diverse than that.
David, we found a video of you giving a turtle CPR. How do you give it a turtle CPR? Set the stage for us.
Okay, well, some of the work that I do is to survey and monitor rare wildlife in Alabama, and that's as part of my work with the Alabama Natural Heritage Program. One of the very rare species is the Alabama red-bellied turtle. It's in Mobile Bay, and it inhabits these wetlands with changing water levels. It's tidally influenced. And unfortunately, the water levels went up a little higher than we anticipated and ended up flooding a trap and drowning a turtle. I know that other people had tried giving mouth-to-mouth and CPR to turtles before, and so I figured I'd give it a shot. And the trick was really the chest compressions, because you can't really get through that shell. So I just kind of had to reach back and push the legs in to get that kind of motion. And I didn't actually get my lips on the turtle's mouth, but I was able to blow enough into it. And after a few minutes, it started taking some breaths and seemed to revive.
Yeah, it's a pretty incredible video. The turtle does seem to kind of suddenly come to life, and it's animated again. So you're not actually, it's not mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, but you were blowing air in there, it sounds like.
That's true. Yes, that's accurate.
And did the turtle make it?
Yeah, it as you mentioned, it seemed active and awake, and so we placed it in the water, and it did swim off.
It just swam away, and it's not tagged, so you can't check back in to see how it's doing, huh?
It was marked, and the way that we mark turtles is by taking a file to its shell, and depending on the position of where those marks are, they correspond to individual numbers, so they do have individual IDs. Don't think we've caught that one again yet, but it's a large bay that it's living in, so maybe it's minding its own business.
Now, it's a really cool video. David, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
That was David Steen, assistant research professor with the Alabama Natural Heritage Program at the Auburn University Museum of Natural History. And if you could use a little pick-me-up, check out that video of David giving a turtle CPR on WPR.org/next. Coming up, the hunt for an Earth-like exoplanet is heating up. Astronomer Eric Wilcott says that's a good thing because there are lots of them out there. You're listening to Because Science. I'm Veronica Rickert. It's Because Science. I'm Veronica Rickert. Eric Wilcott has had one foot on good old planet Earth and another in the stars ever since he was a kid. Today, he's a professor in the Department of Astronomy at UW-Madison, and he gets to travel the world in his quest to unlock the secrets of stars and galaxies and exoplanets. On Because Science, we pull scientists out of the lab, or from behind the telescope in this case, and spend some time getting to know them. Eric, great to have you here.
No, my pleasure. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, do you remember the first moment that you looked up at the stars and decided that you wanted to know more? In fact, you wanted to be a scientist.
I don't remember the first moment. I do remember when I was about, I would say, 8 years old. My parents got me a telescope for Christmas. It was one of these JCPenney specials, 2 inches in diameter, and I got hooked on that. And so I used to take it out into the backyard and try to find whatever stars there were to find and point my telescope at them. And it was really cold. I'd call my mother out to come look at the telescope. It's just too cold out there. But that's when I got started looking at the stars.
And now you know, I'm sure you have your favorite places to go to look for the stars. And now sort of the world is your oyster and where you can go. Where do you like to go? And not just as a scientist, but as a person where it gives you sort of the most thrill to look up
there. Wow, good question. I'd say two places. One is Yosemite National Park. Up at Tuolumne Meadows. I forget the elevation, but we were camping there. This is years ago. Beautiful fall evening, just clear as can be. And I don't think I've ever quite seen as many stars as I saw on that night in Yosemite. And the other place is a little bit more professional. It's where we have our observatory in South Africa, where the sky is as dark as you can imagine it being. And you can see the Milky Way clear down the horizon, which is really remarkable. And the southern sky is spectacular. For those of us that live in the northern hemisphere, we're missing out on a lot.
Oh, really?
If you get to go to the southern hemisphere, the southern sky is absolutely stunning.
Why? How come?
Where we sit in the Milky Way galaxy, where the Earth and the Sun sit in the Milky Way galaxy, our perspective from the northern hemisphere is of mostly of one side of the galaxy. It's kind of a boring side.
That's so disappointing.
I shouldn't say that. If you're in the southern hemisphere, you get to see the southern Milky Way. And there you get to see these tremendous dark clouds in the sky. Plus there are neighboring galaxies, the Magellanic Clouds, which are my thesis objects. So I have a certain affinity for them. So the southern sky is just absolutely gorgeous. And so if you get the chance, go down to the southern hemisphere.
Before you said in the southern hemisphere, you could look up and you could see the Milky Way all the way to the horizon.
Yes.
Can you describe that for me? What do you mean?
So if you go out in Wisconsin on a nice summer evening, nice and clear, you'll see up ahead the constellation Cygnus, see a really bright star that's Vega, and there's this sort of faint patch of light in the sky. That's the Milky Way. And if you look at it, it gets maybe to close to the horizon, maybe 30 degrees off the horizon, that faint glow of light. If you're at our telescope in South Africa, you can follow that faint glow all the way down to the horizon, which means there's really just no lights around. And the sky is that dark that you can see all of those stars clear down to the horizon.
And it sounds like you spend a lot of time in South Africa, do
yes.
some of your work there. There's the South African Large Telescope, I understand, is one of the reasons you visit South Africa. What can you see with that when you've got not just your JCPenney special, but you've got the big rig?
The big rig. So SALT is a 10-meter telescope. So the mirror itself is 10 meters in diameter. It's really, really spectacular. And what we use it is – the old way of thinking about telescopes is they're giant light buckets. And the sense is if you want to collect light, the bigger your bucket, the more light you're going to get. And so the bigger the telescope, the more light we can gather. And so some of the things that we work on, for example, is a sense of kind of like doing archaeology, and that is looking in the past and looking how things formed, particularly galaxies, stars, looking farther out into the universe, so you're looking farther back in time.
Is that something that you can grasp in a way that isn't just on paper, that you're looking at things from the past? As a scientist, does your brain get that? Mine doesn't quite get it, but I know what you mean.
You always reckon – I think as a scientist I can because that we're looking at – we want to know how the universe has changed over time. And we haven't been around long enough to watch it change over time, at least in sort of the big scale. So yeah, we do internalize this notion that if I look at a very distant object, I'm seeing that object as it looked – a billion years ago, 2 billion years ago, 10 billion years ago. And so that giving me this window of what things used to look like. So, yeah, we do. We can internalize it a little bit.
It doesn't explode your brain.
It
huh?
does like not. It does not explode the brain. No.
Interesting. No. Well, I know that before you got here, and here being UW-Madison, mm-hmm. where you're on faculty, you worked at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in New Mexico. And what was it like there, looking at stars from the desert?
So the stars are spectacular. And actually, I was down there. One of the comets came by. It's gorgeous. But the NRAO, the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, is the premier radio telescope in the world. And I don't know if you've seen the movie Contact.
I have. I was wondering if I saw the pictures and I thought, that looks like Contact.
Yeah, the second half of Contact was filmed at the VLA. It was filmed, unfortunately, the year after I left, so I wasn't in it.
You missed Jody.
I did. Actually, one of my colleagues was her science advisor, so that could have been me.
Oh, that could have been you.
But so it is the premier radio telescope in the world right now. 27 dishes. They each are 27 meters in diameter, and they're just impressive structures. And when you go out into the desert and you see this array of telescopes, that's an impressive sight of sort of a technological feat to put this together. And the fact that they all work together to get an image of the sky at radio wavelengths is really amazing.
Well, I know that you're also into exoplanets and the study and the search for Earth-like exoplanets. What do we know? What's the cutting edge there?
We know a lot. So if you go back 20 years, we knew of one solar system, the one we lived in. So when I went to graduate school, that was it. In terms of planetary science, was our solar system. Now I think the number's up to maybe 3,000 planets around other stars that we know of. There's probably more. And in a sense, you can think of almost every star you look at in the night sky probably has a planet around it. So the next time you're out at night and you're looking at all the stars, most of the ones you see will have a planet orbiting them, or maybe more. And so the idea now is, now we've discovered all these planets, let's see what they look like. And let's see, as we say, what the architecture of their planetary system is. We have this idea of what a planetary system should look like. You get a star and you get these four little rocky planets that we know in our solar system close to the star, and the big gas giants far away from the star. The other systems don't look like that. We have yet to discover one that actually looks like our solar system. But we do know of maybe a handful, maybe a dozen planets that are probably rocky, that are probably about the size of the Earth, maybe a little bit bigger, orbiting relatively close to their stars. And so those are the ones that people think of when they ask the question of, is there some other habitable world out there? It's that dozen objects right now that sort of capture the imagination as could potentially be habitable based on their size and how far away they are from the star.
And maybe could potentially harbor life.
Potentially
already, like
could harbor.
Actually,
the course I'm teaching this semester with a couple of colleagues in geology is our life in the universe class. And this is one of the things that we will be looking at. How, for an astronomer to discover the planet, it's hard, but we can do that. To go the next level to see is there actually life there, that's really hard. And we're not there yet.
As a scientist, you know, you grew up in the same sci-fi culture that I did, and you watch probably E.T. These movies, Contact.
Yep,
is that something that still gets you going to think about E.T.'s, extraterrestrials out there?
I think a little bit about extraterrestrials. Not so much in that there's, you know, E.T.'s going to visit us, but thinking about, are there other civilizations, advanced civilizations out there? And it's a serious scientific question now, whereas it really wasn't 2 decades ago. So I do think about E.T., but more, I actually, maybe this is the scientist in me, excited about thinking about what are the different ways that life can get started? What are the different environments in which life can get started? And that's a really interesting question when you got to bring in the biologist to understand how early life formed on the Earth and whether those conditions can be found somewhere else. But on the science fiction side, you know, I ran out to see Star Wars.
Me too. Yeah, me too. Yeah. Well, so if you game out the odds there that there is life in the vastness of space, and we don't even really know how vast space I don't know, how probable is it? Where are you putting your money?
I put my money that life is very probable. And so I am convinced that there has to be somewhere else some life. Is it advanced? I'm not sure about that. But if you think about it, on the Earth, it took something like 4 billion years before really sort of multicellular structured creatures existed on the Earth. Most of the Earth's history has been filled with bacteria, right? And so finding bacteria on another planet is really hard. But I am sure that there's life out there. We just haven't found it yet.
Would you be excited to find bacteria?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Even
great.
Bacteria?
Oh, yeah. That'd be fantastic.
Why bacteria? Because you know it's sort of the building blocks.
You know it's the building blocks. You know. Okay. I mean, fundamentally, we have yet to find any evidence that life got started anywhere else. So just to find bacteria somewhere else or evidence that there was bacteria somewhere else, that sort of changes the story. That, yeah, life can get started in a range of environments. What it leads to, we may not know yet, but we know that it can get started.
Looking at some data from U.S. News and World Report, I saw recently that it said African-American men are one of the only minority groups that are not making progress in STEM. This is as of 2015. Why do you think that is?
That's a really hard question. And I don't know enough about the, you know, the sort of the sociology of it to understand what the root causes of it. And I think, you know, clearly education is going to play a huge role. Clearly you get into two issues. I think minorities in general are not represented in science as well as they should be. You know, some of the factors are the conditions in the high schools that are where those students are going to high school. That's something that we have to address. It's a really big issue. One thing that we might be able to do is that, you know, when you're growing up as a kid, thinking about what you want to go into, there are role models, and I don't think we can underplay the importance of role models of saying to, you know, a 7 or 8 year old, yeah, I can do that because there's somebody who is doing that who looks like me. So that's important. So we need role models. And then the other thing is we need to make it clear that science actually is a path to improving one's economic standing, being able to take care of one's family, being able to give back to the community where one is coming from. We have to make that connection. And I think there probably is something to the sense that if I'm going to advance myself, boy, I'm going to go be a doctor or going to be a lawyer because I've heard of that. I understand what that is. I know they make money. I'm going to do that. Whereas I think we got to do a better job of getting science out there as a really powerful discipline. And I think that's a message that I think we have to keep putting out, broadly speaking, into the public, but also into the minority communities in particular.
Do you think some of those things you're talking about, are they starting to happen already, or is there just a lot of elbow grease to be done?
I think there's still a lot of elbow grease. I think it's happening a little bit, but I think there's a lot of elbow grease. I have noticed even in astronomy over the years, you know, our national meetings are becoming a lot more diverse than they used to be. And, you know, I could go to meetings 15, 20 years ago and be the only African-American in a room. Actually, at our national meetings, it's hard to do that anymore, right? And so I think we're seeing that kind of improvement. There's a lot of work to be done, but I think we are seeing some improvement.
Well, I want to ask you, I mean, we've been talking about time on a grand scale, space mm-hmm. on a grand scale. I mean, does it ever feel like you spend so much time thinking about the universe in these vast expanses mm-hmm. that it seems kind of pointless to have to tie your shoes and brush your teeth and do these little bitty things? Does it feel like, you know, you want to be part of that instead
of down here? No, we try to remain really grounded. You know, and I've got a lucky career. This is fantastic. To be able to think about and study and look at magnificent things in the sky. But in the end, you know, so I spend a good chunk of my time dealing with the everyday issues, teaching classes, interacting with students. And so that helps keep you grounded, not getting too carried away with the big picture and always looking up.
Eric, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Awesome. Thank you very much.
That was Eric Wilcox. He teaches astronomy at UW-Madison, where he's Associate Dean for the Natural and Mathematical Sciences. He likes his pizza with traditional toppings, and his biggest fear in the field is scorpions. You can hear more answers to his Science Slam questions at WPR.org/next. If you want to feel like a total failure as a human being, try to make sure you get your kids exactly the right amount of screen time. Or decide you're going to stay off your phone and do one thing at a time. Screens are everywhere, and we need to figure out how to be smart about how we use them. The American Academy of Pediatrics says children from 2 to 5 years old should have 1 hour or less of screen time per day, and kids 6 and older, parents can determine their own guidelines. But it's not always so simple. David Gagnon studies mobile technology and learning at UW-Madison, where he's the director of the Field Day Lab. He's also a dad. And even with those credentials, he says there's no one simple trick for getting screen time right. David, thanks for coming in.
Hi.
Screen time is a huge issue right now for parents and for adults now. It seems like screens can go anywhere with you, and that's part of the problem. And it also seems like limiting screen time can be sort of this fool's errand. It's hard to do because they're ubiquitous. So is all screen time created equal?
Yeah, I think this is a really good question because I feel like we've come up with this term, screen time, and it's not a very detailed or you know, very rich term. So I think we're just saying, you know, any time where we're interacting with a device is equivalent to any other time interacting with a device. And I think that that's obviously a pretty narrow version of thinking about this. So, for example, I think it's really interesting to even go back to scholars like Marshall McLuhan, and he had this notion of like hot and cold media. And I find that to be a really interesting place to start because he talks about hot media being the kind of media that does the work for the viewer or for the reader. So, for example, a high fidelity CG scene in a big action movie would do that. There's nothing left to the imagination. Like, they have designed every single part of it. But then cold media, you could think of this as like a literary work or, you know, text. And you're doing the majority of the work. It's in your mind's eye that these characters are living and talking and these scenes are described. And it's a really different process when you're working with cold media because it's not doing the work for you. You're doing the work. So I find that to be like an interesting way to start talking about screen time in a much richer way. So, for example, with my own kids, I have a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old. One of the big distinctions we draw from is whether they're watching shows or playing games. And we talk about games being, you know, certain kinds of activities that end up being really rich, very active engagement. And they're inventing their own little worlds and they're coming up with their own stories and it becomes a very generative activity versus the way they glaze over when they're watching, you know, cartoons with their high-pitched noises and very rapid-fire visuals. So I think there's a whole spectrum here to be explored, and I'd love it for parents and teachers to be able to talk about it in an informed way that helps us think about what kind of experience we're trying to have for kids.
Sounds like the hot and cold thing is also, you could frame it as active versus passive.
Yes, I think that's a really nice way to put it. And when we think about activeness, I mean, this is where I know I want to be all day long for the most part. Is in these places where we're generating and creating and emergence is happening. And I can see when the kids that we work with, for example, you know, we put them in a role a lot of the time where they're not passively, again, consumers of media, but they become active producers of media. So another way that, you know, you can kind of flip the script is to say you can have as much time with a computer as you want as long as you're the one in charge and you're the one making with it. So now we've got another kind of dimension to talk about how we're interacting with these devices. So my kids can do stop motion Lego work on their iPad as long as they want. But you find that they actually, there's only so much energy. And just like adults, they want some kind of downtime as well. So we can set these boundaries that are very generative and allow them to be creators. But we find that they get tired. So there's only so much of that energy in a person, you know, in a given segment.
Really, as long as they want, because we have some games that the kids play, you know, something like Minecraft that is more creative. But if they do it for too long, this guilt trigger goes off in my head and I think, oh, they're on screens and it's been half an hour and I need to chop them off. But you think that's misguided if they're doing something creative?
No, I totally agree with you. I'm just talking about my own kids. So I think Minecraft is a really good example of a game that has potential for being very, very generative, but it goes down the road of being a grind as well. So a grind I would define from the video games world is when you are doing a very little amount of actual creative effort and you're repeating it over and over and over and over again. And I certainly have witnessed kids that can do this in Minecraft for tens of hours or hundreds of hours. And there's a really different activity from being in this kind of like semi-aware, semi-present grind with Minecraft versus, you know, you see kids that do all kinds of really incredible, very active stuff in Minecraft. So I think that it's really hard, again, to just keep it at a very surface level of screen time or Minecraft time. And we've got to actually think, like, well, what are people doing with that time?
Right, but then do you have to look over a shoulder and say, okay, he's building a castle, so that's sort of creative versus, you know, something just killing a blob over and over in Minecraft. I mean, you as a parent, it's really hard sometimes to have these skills and to know what's going on and to track it because already I feel like my kids kind of know more about these worlds than I do.
And I find that also really interesting because you know, we work in the world of games, so I hear this a lot. You know, little Johnny is over there doing their thing, and we just don't even understand it. And I would suggest, I know it's hard, but get in there and understand it, and don't look over a shoulder, but actually let's make this a participatory thing. Again, so back to my kids, just because I've got more authority there. There's a big difference even from go play with Legos or let's play with Legos together. And I think there's something really interesting about parents and kids designing worlds together, or even kids designing worlds together. So Minecraft becomes an interesting thing to talk about because it becomes gateways into all of these interesting practices, from doing systems thinking and developing new kinds of geometry and moving around 3D space and participating in online communities. And all these things are quite rich and really exciting. But at the end of the day, I think we all need a little bit of downtime. And I think the idea that you look at a kid that's on Minecraft and you say it's a good activity, that's dangerous. Mm. And it seems like this is an opportunity actually to actually create something with our kids.
That was David Gagnon. He's the director of the Field Day Lab at UW-Madison. Coming up, a battle of epic proportions featuring the words of two giants of science, Stephen Hawking and William Shatner. You're listening to Because Science. I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Because Science. I'm Veronica Rickert. If your conception of metabolism is limited to your gene size, you're missing out. The science is much bigger and more interesting than that. Gemma Tarlak is with us now. She's a senior editor at Discover, where she wrote 20 Things You Didn't Know About Metabolism. Hey, Gemma.
Hey.
So you've been thinking about metabolism, which I don't think of as a very cheerful subject, but it's an important subject. We can agree on that much. So, bare bones, what is metabolism?
Okay, so metabolism, probably think it's what you want to rev up so that you can fit into those skinny jeans and look good. But the truth of the matter is the word metabolism actually refers to all the chemical reactions going on within an organism that keep it alive. So it's not just about fitting into your skinny jeans. It's about breathing. It's about energy. It's about bone growth. It's about everything. These chemical reactions are happening all through every organism on the planet.
So this word, it's a lot broader than we think of it. Where does the word come from?
It's actually derived from a Greek word for change. And that's really the key to it all, because metabolism is all about power, how power is acquired and how power is spent. Because obviously, say, if you're building bones in an organism, you need to power that bone building process. So where do you get the power from? You can't just plug yourself in, you know, to an outlet. So it's all about acquiring power through sources like food and converting that power into power that's usable for the building process.
In terms of how it works, the nuts and bolts, can you lay that out? How does metabolism actually function?
Well, at its core, metabolism is a balance of catabolism, which is breaking energy down into usable units, and anabolism, which is using those units that you've broken down for all the vital projects throughout the body. And, you know, there are different kinds of metabolism. We think metabolism actually evolved in single-celled organisms as far back as 3.5 billion, with a B, years ago. And right way back then, because of really low levels of atmospheric oxygen on our planet, the process was fermentative. You know, you could think of yeast, for example, today has a partially fermentative metabolism. But as oxygen increased in the Earth's atmosphere and the organisms became more complex, then you got things like photosynthesis, which is the plant form of metabolism, even something called chemolithotrophy. And that is basically organisms that live in crazy places like deep underground. We're talking about bacteria and archaea, which are another type of single-celled organism. They use chemolithotrophic metabolism to get their energy from things like ammonia, because they don't have access to oxygen or sunlight.
Now, so a billion-dollar question is, can you actually rev up? You know, that's the phrase the magazines always use that. Can
boost,
you rev
boost.
Up, boost your metabolism? Can it be done, or is that a lot of hocus pocus?
You know, so far there's no magic bullet. And I think we've all heard about green tea extract. A lot of times you hear, oh, if you have green tea extract, your metabolism gets revved up and all this great stuff. And maybe not skinny jeans, but at least yoga pants for you and all this fun. But the fact of the matter is research is really mixed, and it's really basically the results have been statistically insignificant, and they do vary based on where you get the green extract from. But pretty much for both weight loss and weight management, the results are so negligible that it's statistically insignificant. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe have green tea if you like it, if you enjoy that grassy taste. I do personally, but don't expect to use it to, you know, go supermodel anytime soon.
Dang.
Sorry.
Well, you did find some extremes of metabolism in the animal world that seem to be working in high gear. On one end, we have the hummingbird.
Yeah, particularly the ruby-throated hummingbird. That particular species has the highest metabolic rate of any vertebrate ever. And it beats its wings up to 200 times a second. Mm. But of course, to maintain that super high metabolism, it typically consumes about its body weight in nectar every day. So, you know, the old saying, eat like a bird. Yeah, don't do that if you have any hope of those skinny jeans.
Well, so on the other end of the spectrum, we've got our friend the sloth. What do we know about sloth metabolism?
Well, the interesting thing specifically about three-toed sloths is they do have the lowest metabolic rate of any mammal. And you might be wondering, well, are they just lazy? But the fact of the matter is that super low metabolism is an adaptation. It's part of a suite of adaptations that evolved because they live in a really energy poor forest canopy environment. So to live in that environment, they have evolved a low metabolism so that their power requirements aren't as great.
Well, Gemma, not the cheeriest metabolic news, but super interesting. Thank you so much for sharing all that.
Thanks as always.
That was Gemma Tarlag, senior editor at Discover Magazine. And now, who said it? Theoretical physicist Stephen Hawking or this guy?
What is a man but that lofty spirit, that sense of enterprise, that devotion to something that cannot be sensed, cannot be realized, but only dreamed, the highest reality?
We are joined here in the studio with Carl Engelking from Discover Magazine. Hey, Carl.
Hi, Veronica. How are you?
I'm good. And we've got a listener on the line with us, too. We've got Nick, who is going to be facing off against me, a doomed proposition, might I add. Nick, thanks a lot for playing along today.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having me.
So before we get rolling, how big of a sci-fi fan would you say you are?
I give myself a B-plus to an A-minus.
You consume a lot of stuff?
Pretty, you know, every now and then. Yeah, I like a good space story.
All right, let's roll. Carl, you brought in a quiz for us. This is one that you did on the Discover podcast. It's Only Science. And the topic of this quiz is who said it, William Shatner or Stephen Hawking?
Yeah, I wanted to challenge the team at Discover to tell the difference between some of the quotes that Stephen Hawking and William Shatner had said. William Shatner can be surprisingly profound, and Stephen Hawking can weigh in on things that you wouldn't expect him to weigh in on. They both talk about space often, so there's a surprising amount of overlap between the things that Stephen Hawking, theoretical physicist, said, and William Shatner, a producer, actor, of course, famous for playing James T. Kirk on the USS Enterprise.
And to be clear, Nick, this is not Captain Kirk talking. This is William Shatner as himself. Right,
yes,
Carl?
This is him in his own words.
Okay.
Oh, that's
Are you
good.
Ready, Nick?
Oh, I'm ready.
So I'll read this first quote, and you'll have to tell me who said it. It would not be beyond the realms of possibility that somewhere outside of our own universe lies another, different universe, and in that universe, Zane is still in one direction.
I can't believe either of them said that.
Weighing in on One Direction.
That's a real quote from someone.
Yep.
Nick, do you want to take the first swing at that one?
You know, as much as I really wish to hear Stephen Hawking say One Direction or Zane, at some point in my life, I feel like I'm going to have to go with Captain Kirk on this one.
That was Stephen Hawking. He weighed in on that. Yep, he weighed in on that controversy when that was big news several months ago. All right, here's another one.
I'm as shocked as you are, Nick.
Now, this one's for you, Veronica?
Yeah.
What a glorious demise it would be to burn up in space.
What a glorious demise
yes.
it would be to burn up in space. I sound like Captain Kirk already, don't I? to burn up in space. I'm going to say William Shatner.
You are correct on that one.
Woo! Sorry, Nick.
All right, this one gets a little scarier. The rise of powerful AI will either be the best or the worst thing ever to happen to humanity. We don't know which.
This I do think is Stephen Hawking. I think I remember reading this article. It was very apocalyptic.
You are correct. So I believe you guys are tied now.
I'm surprised at that because I thought Stephen Hawking's whole thing was that we should be terrified about the rise of AI. And he's saying there that it could be either one. That one surprises me.
Yeah, he leaves it a little open-ended. Knowing what he's said about AI in the past, I think we know which way he might lean.
He's leaning a little more in one direction now.
Yeah.
One direction.
Okay, this one's for you, Veronica.
Yeah.
There is no doubt that there is life out there. The mathematics of it lead you to that absolute conclusion. In my mind, there is no doubt that the universe teems. Teems with life in all its forms.
Hmm. Okay, here's my thing. I think that I cannot hear Stephen Hawking repeating teams twice, but I also feel like it's hard to imagine William Shatner using that word. So,
and he's talking about math, too.
And he's talking, okay, is that a that sounds like a clue.
I am
he's
just
about math.
Repeating things.
Okay, so let's go with Stephen Hawking.
And that was William Shatner.
Ah, you misled me.
I just want to keep
both
it close.
Been bamboozled.
Let's see. Here's a quick one. People who boast about their IQ are losers.
I also really want this to be Stephen Hawking. I'm going to go with that.
It was Stephen Hawking.
It was Stephen Hawking.
Yep.
Okay.
So what,
Nick's
2-1
doing
right
really
now?
Well.
Yeah. Here's another one. If time travel is possible, where are the tourists from the future?
That, to me, sounds like Stephen Hawking, because I feel like William Shatner has that unbridled enthusiasm about space that he thinks that there still could be time travelers, even though we don't see them. So I'm going to go with Stephen Hawking.
Your hunch was correct. All right, here's a very colorful one for Nick. Why does the lizard stick out his tongue? The lizard sticks out its tongue because that's the way it's listening and looking and tasting its environment.
Oh, this could go... Either way, I feel like I've been riding strong on Stephen Hawking this whole time, so I'm going to go with William Shatner again.
And you'd be correct. You got a good hunch or a good feel for this game.
Well, I feel like I know my captain.
And this one's for you, Veronica. We are approaching a crisis where people see not just the necessity, but the Armageddon of not cooperating.
Oh. Well, that's a little preachy. Captain Kirk is preachy. I don't know if William Shatner is preachy. Stephen Hawking seems to enjoy the soapbox. See how I'm going inside the psychological makeup of the two? I'm going to say Stephen Hawking again.
And that was William Shatner.
Ah!
Oh.
Dang. I stand corrected. I guess he's preachier than I thought he was.
I don't know if we're keeping track of score or what the score where the score
You're
stands
You're the quiz master.
Oh, I should have been writing this down. I think I think it's like 3-1.
I think I got 2, Carl.
3-2, okay.
I'm going to correct you. I'm pretty sure I'm at 2, but I think that Nick is still leading.
So this one's for Nick. I am discounting reports of UFOs. Why would they appear only to cranks and weirdos?
Oh, I'm going to go with Stephen Hawking.
And you're correct.
Yeah.
Nick is killing it.
Yeah, so that brings the unofficial score to 4-2, I'll say.
All right, well, sure, now you're weighing in, now that I'm losing so badly.
All right, well, let's get you on the comeback trail here.
All right, maybe this can be our final question.
Okay. The possibilities that are suggested in quantum physics tell us that everything that we're looking at may not be, in fact, there. So the underlying nature of being is weird.
Okay. Wow. Nick knows the answer. I can tell by the way he's laughing maniacally. The use of the word weird is what I'm zeroing in on. Weirdos was also in the last question. I'm going to say William Shatner.
You're correct.
Woohoo! Come back! But I think, Carl, I think that Nick still beat me.
Yeah, it's 4-3. I guess I could have made that worth like 3 points or something. But
Nick, congrats to you. You emerge the victor. And to you, I say, may you live long and prosper.
Oh, well, thank you very much. It was a tough battle.
Before we let you go, are you more about Captain Kirk or do you like Picard?
Oh, Picard, all the way.
Picard. What about you, Carl?
I'm a Captain Kirk guy. But honestly, I wouldn't mind if Stephen Hawking would steer the ship.
Yeah, that's probably a better best-case scenario for us all. Guys, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Carl Engelking is our quizmaster. He's the online editor at Discover Magazine. Because Science was produced by me, Veronica Rickert, and Amanda Magnus. Special thanks to Adam Friedrich, Tom Blaine, Brittany True, and Carl Christensen from Wisconsin Public Radio, along with Scotty Lee Myers and Lisa Nalbandian from our WPR studios in Milwaukee. Thanks to Captain Picard disciple Nick Knittle, and thanks to our friends at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha, Gemma Tarlack, Carl Engelking, and Becky Lang. This is Because Science. Thanks for listening.